Brett Random and Rose Constantine were back in Finn Durandal's apartment again, sitting in their usual chairs, waiting for instructions. The Durandal was off somewhere playing the good Paragon with Emma Steele, but he'd promised to be back as soon as he could credibly slip away and leave his new unwanted partner to her own devices. So Brett and Rose waited, not looking at each other, not talking. Brett had already dosed his aching stomach with everything in his and Finn's medicine cabinet, and none of it had done a damned bit of good. Brett rubbed soothingly at his tormented stomach with both hands, and wondered dismally if perhaps he should contact Dr. Happy and use Finn's line of credit to beg a little something. The ache kept him awake at night, and drove him from his bed far too early in the morning, and he was getting really bloody tired of it. No amount of promised money or power was worth this, and Finn's threats of what he would do to Brett if he even thought of leaving were seeming less and less intimidating by the hour. Sometimes Brett thought he would sell his soul, or what little was left of it, if his gut would only stop hurting so badly. He sat slumped down in his chair, his knees almost on a level with his chest, and looked morosely around Finn's place in search of something to occupy his attention. Something small and precious he could smash, perhaps, and claim it was an accident. He had already drunk everything worth drinking and raided the kitchen twice. Sometimes eating something made his stomach feel better, and sometimes it didn't. But Brett had always been a great comfort eater. Trouble was, Finn's culinary tastes tended towards the bland, not to mention the downright boring, and Brett had his standards. He looked cautiously across at Rose, sitting in her chair pulled uncomfortably close beside his. Her head slowly turned, and she looked at him with her dark, unblinking eyes. She'd been looking at him a lot lately, ever since their minds had touched through the Esper drug, when he discovered, very much to his surprise, that there was more to her than just a killer after all. God alone knew what she discovered about him. He was damned if he could read her expression. She was wearing the same tight-fitting red leathers she always wore, the color of drying blood, all the way from her toes to her chin, all 7 feet of her. She made the chair look like it had been built for a child. And even though she was sitting perfectly, almost inhumanly still, she dominated the room with her sheer presence. Brett studied her openly, and she let him. With her bobbed black hair, dark as the night, her deathly pale skin, and savage crimson mouth, she looked like some ancient death goddess, resting from making her rounds of the battlefield, where she tore the eyes from staring faces, like some great and awful gore crow. Brett was hard-pressed to decide whether she was good-looking. She was just too intense, too fierce, too untamed for such conventional verdicts to apply. Striking, certainly. Attractive, like a well-fashioned weapon. Even sexy, in a disturbing and frankly rather sick way. She scared Brett shitless, but then most things did these days. He bit his lip, frowning, as he tried to put into words how he felt about her. She should horrify him, but... He realized he'd been staring at her for a long while, and she hadn't objected. She was still looking at him, calm and curious, as quietly menacing as a coiled snake. Brett swallowed uncomfortably and sat up a little straighter in his chair.
So, Rose, I see you got your levers repaired after you took that hit in the ribs during the riot.
This is another outfit. I have 7 sets, all exactly the same. It saves me from having to waste time deciding what I'm going to wear when I get up in the morning. I have no patience for distractions like that. The Arena Board had a famous designer produce the original set for me. Image is everything, apparently. I didn't object. I like leather, it's practical. And it scares people. That's useful in the arena. Fights can be won and lost over how an opponent sees you.
Brett was taken aback. She'd never spoken so much at one time to him before. In fact, he'd never heard her say that much to anyone before, not even Finn. If it had been anyone else, he'd have said she was confiding in him, maybe even trying to reach out to him. He cast his mind about for something else to say.
They're very nice levers. The color is so you. But don't you ever get uncomfortable in them? I mean, I used to know this girl who made educational features for a mature, discerning audience, and she wore a lot of leather outfits, and she always said they made her sweat like a pig.
I don't sweat. It's bad for the image. That was a joke.
Well, very nearly. Jesus, she'll be trying to smile next. I don't know if I can cope with that.
I'm glad you're here, Brett. I wanted to talk to you. In private. This is difficult for me, Brett. I don't talk much to people. They don't talk much to me. I don't have much in common with people. You've probably noticed. I live for the fight, for the kill. The spurting blood and the look in their eyes as the life goes out of them. And for years, that was all I needed, all I wanted from people. But you, Brett, you're different. I feel differently about you. I want to know you better. And I don't know why.
She's trying to come on to me. I'm not even sure if she knows what that means, but that's what she's trying to do.
Brett seriously considered jumping out of his chair and running for his life, but somehow he didn't. Partly because she'd probably kill him before he reached the door if she decided she'd been insulted, and partly because there was something almost touching in her awkward attempts to reach out to someone else. Maybe for the first time in her life. It didn't make her one bit less scary, but...
You can talk to me, Rose, if you want. What would you like to talk about?
I don't know. This is all new to me. New territory. Is this what friends do?
Well, sometimes. Don't you have any friends, Rose? No, of course not. Silly question.
I never wanted friends. People complicate things. They want things from me. Things I never understood. Friendship, love, sex. Those things have always been a mystery to me. But now, I want to know about you, Brett. Who you are, what you are, who and what you were before we met. Is that the kind of things friends want to know?
Yeah. Yeah, Rose. You got it.
Brett got ready to launch into his usual patter, the carefully rehearsed and polished parcel of lies he always trotted out when he wanted to impress a new woman in his life. But somehow, he couldn't do that to Rose. She wouldn't have appreciated them anyway. So for once, and much to his surprise, Brett told the truth. Brett Random had grown up in the rookery, with a mother who earned the rent on her back, and a whole succession of stepfathers who came and went as the mood took them. Sometimes they gave him money, and sometimes they hit him. But Brett never gave a damn either way. He took to the streets in an early age, looking out for himself because he was the only one he could trust, getting himself into every kind of trouble there was going, teaching himself the art of the con and the dodge, because that was what he was best at, and because he enjoyed it. He made himself a name to be reckoned with before he was out of his teens, while outside the rookery, he carefully constructed a dozen new names, faces, and identities, all of them ready for use at a moment's notice. He made and lost a dozen fortunes before he was 20, and never missed any of them. He wasn't in it for the money. It was the chase and the challenge, and the thrill of the game that consumed him, that made him feel alive. But he never forgot his one distinct claim to true greatness, that he was descended from not one, but two of the Empire's greatest heroes. He was a Random's bastard, through his long-lost father, some wandering soul who'd impressed his mother so much she gave her only child his father's surname. It could all have been a lie, of course, just a line to impress his mother, but Brett didn't think so. He'd always known he was destined for greatness. He could feel it, in his bones and in his soul. One day he would be great himself, whatever it took. You need dreams like that in the rookery.
So there you have it, Rose. The story of my life, such as it is. I am what I have made of myself. The prince at a con and a double bluff. How about you now? What awful and traumatic events divorced you from the rest of humanity and made you into the Wild Rose, the terrible and legendary killer you are today?
I made myself what I am. No one helped me. I had a perfectly normal family and a perfectly normal upbringing. Never actually rich, but always comfortable. I had parents who cared for me and were always there when I needed them. There's nothing in my dull, ordinary past to explain me. I'm just a cuckoo, a monster, a freak of nature. Blood and suffering and slaughter are meat and drink to me. It's music and laughter and sex, and all I ever needed, until now. When our minds touched through the drug, I saw there was more to life than I thought. I saw things that I've always wanted without knowing it. I saw love and sex in your mind. And for the first time, it seemed to me that perhaps there was more to them than the bumping of bodies. There's comfort and sharing and peace of mind and more. I want those things, Brett. I want to know them. Teach me about friendship. Teach me about sex. Show me.
Oh, hell. Why me, Lord?
But you don't say no to a psychopath. So Brett reached out and took her hand in his. He pulled off the crimson leather glove and dropped it in her lap. She looked at him, curiously, dispassionately. Brett brought her bare hand to his face and slowly trailed the tips of her long, slender fingers across his cheek. And slowly, very slowly, guiding her hand with his, he moved her hand from his cheek to his chin to his mouth. Rose frowned, concentrating on the moment, on the sensations. Brett kissed her fingertips, one at a time. Rose pulled her hand away, held it up before her face, and looked at it. Brett sat very still. And then, Rose reached out, took his hand in her deadly killer's hand, and moved his fingertips slowly across her face. He smiled encouragingly. There was something new in the room with them. Brett leaned over in his chair and pressed his other hand on the red leathers over her chest.
Brett, I think...
Don't think. Just feel.
This is new. It isn't like killing.
Oh, not everything has to be about killing.
He took her firmly by the chin and pulled her face close to his. She studied him, wide-eyed. When he kissed her, it was clear this was new to her, too. He showed her what to do, not hurrying, careful not to be aggressive or forceful. This was Rose, after all. He was still scared of her, but he could feel something beginning between them. A new connection that might be friendship or lust or something else entirely. And he had to admit, it was exciting. There was a real charge to making out with someone who might just kill you if you upset her. Rose pulled back, their lips separating almost reluctantly. She looked at Brett, frowning again as she tried to work out how she felt. She looked down at his hand on her breast and put her hand over his, increasing the pressure. Brett slowly undid the buttons of his shirt and pulled it open to reveal his bare chest. He took her bare hand and brought it to his chest. Rose's dark mouth moved in the beginnings of a smile. If it had been anyone else, Brett would have sworn it was a shy smile. He smiled back. Rose's fingertips moved curiously across his chest, not needing his hand to guide her. Finn was back. Brett didn't know whether he felt relieved or not. Rose leaned back in her chair again, pulling on her leather glove, her face calm and impassive. Brett did up his shirt. They were both sitting quietly in their separate chairs, looking in different directions. And if they were both breathing just a little heavily, what of that? Certainly, Finn didn't seem to notice anything amiss as he came bustling in, saying something hearty about a new mission. Brett missed the first few words. He just noticed that his stomach had stopped hurting.
Brett, you're not listening to me.
Hanging on your every word, Sir Durandal. A new mission. Always happy to serve. Wait a minute. Hold everything. Go back. Go previous. Did you just say you wanted me to go out into the city again? You do know I can't show this face in public. Not after gut-shooting a Death Stalker right in front of the camera. Paragons may not be the flavour of the month right now, but the champion still has his fans. Particularly among the peacekeepers. They spot this face and I'm a dead man.
Then show them another face. You have several to choose from, after all. It's your own fault. I have no sympathy. You should have spotted that camera. Very unprofessional behavior.
I was distracted, all right? Conversations like this are why I always prefer to work alone.
You have other identities. Pick one of them. I need you out in the city within the hour.
Within the hour? Jesus, Finn, whatever happened to forward planning? It takes time to become someone else, and visits to a body shop I can trust. The whole point of a backup identity is to produce a whole different image, right down to the body language. You don't just slap on a wig and walk funny.
All you need for now is an appearance sufficiently different that you won't be arrested in the street. Don't worry, the odds are no one would recognize you anyway, where you're going.
There was something in the way he said that which made Brett's heart sink.
All right, I'll bite. Where am I going this time?
I'm sending you to speak with the elves. To make a deal with them on my behalf.
Are you out of your mind? No one goes looking for elves. I like having my brain where it is, not leaking out of my ears. I wouldn't go near an elf if you gave me a dozen S-blockers, a full body force shield, and my own portable disruptor cannon. They're crazy.
Finn waited patiently for him to run down.
The elves will agree to the deal because I am going to offer them something they want even more than me. And you will go and talk to them on my behalf, Brett, because I require it of you. And I just won't take no for an answer. I have every confidence in your abilities. You've always been very persuasive. After all, you were able to talk the Death Stalker into leaving his post during a riot. You must have been very persuasive to manage that.
Brett hesitated, suddenly uncertain. Was Finn saying he knew about Brett's new Esper power of compulsion? Or did he just suspect?
I'll go with Brett to see the elves.
Brett and Finn both looked at her sharply, more than a little startled.
Now, why would you want to do that, Rose?
Because I need the exercise. Because I'm interested. I never got to test myself against the elves when they came to the arena. I would like to see an elf close up.
You're very valuable to me, Rose. I don't think I want to risk you on a mission like this. Besides, you were caught on that camera too, fighting the Death Stalker.
I'm going.
Rose stared at Finn with her mad, bad, and dangerous eyes, and even he had to look away. Brett decided to break the awkward silence.
So just how am I supposed to make contact with the elves anyway? Put an ad in the Logris Times, perhaps? Utter lunatic, seek similar?
I have an address. Well, actually, it's more of a location. A meeting place. It's all arranged. Dr. Happy was only too pleased to act as a go-between. For a consideration. It seems the good doctor deals with and for absolutely everybody.
But why would the elves agree to talk to you? After what you did in the arena? No one's ever killed that many elves in one place before. They probably lull themselves to sleep coming up with new and horrible ways to torture you to death. What could you possibly offer them that could get you off that hook? This has to be a trap, Finn.
Quite possibly. That's why you're going instead of me. Just the sight of me in the flesh would probably drive them over the edge before they had a chance to consider what I'm offering. But I'm sure they'll listen to you, Brett, you fast-talking devil. Your new Esper abilities should protect you from possession. And Rose, well, I hate to think what would become of any poor elf stupid enough to venture inside her head. Here be tigers. Make them listen, Brett. I have so much to offer, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend, or at least my ally. Now, off you go. Do try and make it back in time for tea. We're having toasted crumpets.
Hold it. You haven't told me yet just what it is I'm supposed to offer the elves that's guaranteed to win their support.
So Finn told him, and Brett's stomach started hurting all over again. Brett's new face and look wasn't all that different from before, But the subtle changes he made added up to a sufficiently striking impression that he felt reasonably confident about going out in public. His hair was now butter yellow, his eyes were a pale blue, and some carefully applied makeup accentuated the hollows of his face, giving him a gaunt, hungry look. Lifts in his shoes made him taller, and padding at the shoulders changed his body image, all of which added up to a whole new look. It took Brett about 10 minutes in a private room. He walked back into the main room with his new look.
Oh, bravo!
Rose nodded respectfully. No one, in the rookery or out of it, had seen all of Brett's faces and identities. It was safer that way. When you work the confidence game for a living, you never knew when you might upset someone with real power and influence. Someone sufficiently humiliated that they would only settle for revenge of the bloodiest kind. Someone who could afford to put up a really tempting reward. That was when it would come in handy, to be able to disappear so completely that neither friend nor foe could find you. Brett had faces and aliases he hadn't even used yet. Of course, it had to be said, when you were walking down a street with Rose Constantine at your side, not many people were going to be looking at you. Brett had persuaded her to cover her familiar leathers with a long and voluminous black robe and hidden her infamous face behind a sparkling silver hollow mask, but she was still 7 feet tall and walked like a predator in a world of prey. She might not look like the Wild Rose anymore, but she still turned quite a few heads. Brett would have felt less conspicuous walking along with a Grendel.
I like your new look. It's pretty.
Don't get too used to it. This face and voice are just for this outing. Once the elves have seen it, I'm scrapping it forever. I don't want them to have any means of tracking me down.
Rose looked at him from behind her shimmering mask.
They're telepaths, Brett. They'll recognize the shape of your mind, not your face.
Oh, bugger. You're quite right, of course. I'm new to all this Esper shit. I always stayed well clear of them in the past. Esper's deaf in my line of business. Still, hopefully my new abilities will be enough to keep them out of my mind. Well, Finn seemed to think so.
Finn would say whatever he felt he had to get you to go on this mission.
You are allowed to lie to me, you know, to build up my confidence. I wouldn't hold it against you.
Are we nearly there yet?
Rose, you've been asking me that for the last half hour. I will tell you when we're there. Now quiet down and try to look inconspicuous. And try hard. The zoo's right round this corner.
Finn Durandal had arranged for his agents to meet the elf's agents somewhere under the Imperial Zoo. Brett felt a distinct thrill as he led Rose through the huge steel gates with their proud legend, We Preserve. He hadn't been to the zoo since one of his more amiable stepfathers had brought him here as a birthday treat when he was just a kid. The gate seemed somewhat smaller and less impressive than he remembered, but then that was childhood for you. Certainly the grounds of the zoo seemed just as large. The Imperial Zoo and the Parade of the Endless contained more strange, wondrous, and downright weird creatures in one place than anywhere else in the Empire, including Parliament. Thousands of alien species had been brought in from all across the Empire, all of them guaranteed non-sentient, of course, most of them the last few surviving examples of their kind. All that was left, after the investigator purges of past centuries, when just to be different was to be seen as a threat. The zoo had extensive cloning and engineering programs running, and species on the edge of extinction were being resurrected every day. But still and all, it was a slow business. In the meantime, the zoo kept its specimens alive and well cared for, and let the public in to look at them, to provide funding for future research. We preserve, said the zoo, undoing the crimes of the past. Guilt can be a powerful motivation. Each specimen was kept in surroundings as close as possible to its home planet, reinforced by hollow illusions where necessary, and force shields rather than bars, for practical as well as aesthetic reasons. Some of the creatures didn't even know they were in a zoo, and there were tangle fields on call, powered by their own private generators, just in case. It was important for the visitors to feel safe, or they wouldn't come and spend their money. As always, the zoo was packed with tourists, because it wasn't a trip to the Parade of the Endless if you hadn't seen the Imperial Zoo. Brett and Rose were actually able to make their way through the zoo without attracting much attention. They strolled along, taking their time, studying the displays and sharing a bag of peanuts, making small talk while Brett checked carefully to see that they weren't being followed. Actually, Brett made the small talk. Rose didn't have the knack. Brett tried holding hands with her, but it felt frankly unnatural, so he gave up. He would have liked to check out a few of the people nearest him with his ASP, but surrounded by so many alien minds, he didn't dare lower his mental shields for fear of being overwhelmed.
Who do you think the elves will send to talk with us?
He was confident no one was going to be able to overhear them in the midst of the general din from the crowds and the alien exhibits.
They wouldn't put up one of their really heavy hitters, not for the likes of us, would they?
Who knows why the elves do anything? I'd like to kill an elf, one of the few things I haven't killed yet.
Rose, promise me you'll leave all the talking to me.
I can be diplomatic when I have to be.
Your idea of diplomacy is to shoot someone in the face rather than in the back.
Well, mostly yes.
You're going to get us both killed, I just know it.
Then you shouldn't have made me leave my sword behind.
Trust me, Rose. A sword wouldn't get you anywhere against an elf. I just hope they don't send one of their super espers. There are rumors, old stories from the dark days of Esper beginnings about appallingly powerful espers. Mad minds, abominations, created by the Mater Mundi for reasons we can only guess at. Living weapons that could destroy whole cities with a single form. There are those who say these super espers run the elves.
If they were so powerful, why didn't they fight during the rebellion?
Maybe they were too crazy, too uncontrollable to be used, even against Lionstone.
Brett looked about him uneasily. He was spooking himself, but he couldn't seem to stop.
Or just maybe, they refused to be used by anyone, even their own creator. Oh hell, I'm getting a really bad feeling about this. Maybe we should just turn around and get the hell out of here while we still can.
Finn wouldn't like that.
Finn can't turn you inside out just by thinking about it.
I'll protect you, Brett.
Against elves? Against super espers? You're good, Rose, but you're still only human. God alone knows what the super espers are. Even the names give me the creeps. The Grey Train, the Shatter Freak, Screaming Silence, the Spider Harps, Blue Hellfire.
Rose frowned at that last one.
Any connection with Stevie Blue?
No, she came much later. And really, she was never more than just another pyro, despite what the legends say. She'd have had to be at least three people to do everything they said she did. I wish we had an S-block, I really do. Finn could have got us one if he wanted to, but no, that would have been a betrayal of trust. Get the negotiations off to a bad start. Idiot. The only way to negotiate with an elf is from a position of strength, and preferably from a completely different planet. I want to go home and hide under the bed. If I get killed doing this, I swear I'm going to come back and haunt Finn.
I think we're here.
They came to a halt before a single unobtrusive side door marked simply maintenance. It was just slightly off the beaten track in a cul-de-sac you couldn't easily find unless you knew what you were looking for. Above the door, someone had stenciled a stylized blackbird, the sign they'd been told to look for. Brett looked casually about him. No one seemed to be looking, so he tried the door. Brett slipped quickly inside, Rose all but treading on his heels. Brett immediately tried the door again, but it wouldn't open. It had locked itself. Brett shrugged glumly and led Rose down the narrow corridor before them. The walls were bare steel, unburnished, glowing dully in the amber light from the glow spheres set into the ceiling at regular intervals. It could have been just another maintenance tunnel for the service crews, but Brett didn't think so. It was unnaturally quiet. The roar of the crowds and the caged specimens were entirely gone, as though Brett and Rose were now in an entirely different place. Their steps didn't echo at all, as though the sound was absorbed by the walls. The long corridor was full of a strained hush, as though someone unseen was listening to their approach, or perhaps even quietly following them. Brett kept glancing back over his shoulder, but there was never anyone there. But they were being watched. He had no doubt about that. The corridor stretched endlessly away before them, curving back and forth, but leading always, inexorably downwards, into the depths of the earth under the zoo. No maintenance crew would ever have legitimate business this deep. The zoo and the city, and civilization itself, were far above them now. No one would hear them cry out or scream. No one would ever know what happened to them. Brett felt like whimpering. He glanced across at Rose and took some comfort from her customary calm, cold, implacable expression. Whatever she might or might not be feeling, it wasn't affecting her as it did Brett. He was glad she was with him, surprising though the thought was. But the elves were so scary that even Rose Constantine seemed like a comfort in comparison. The corridor finally came to an end at a solid steel door that filled the tunnel from wall to wall. It had no markings and no sign of any lock or handle. Brett looked at the distorted reflections of himself and Rose in the shining metal and shuddered suddenly. There was something really bad on the other side of the door. He could feel it in his bones and in his water. And something was pressing increasingly strongly against the mental shields he'd only learned so recently to construct, to keep the world's thoughts out. Something beat against the walls of his mind, something almost unbearably huge and alien and hungry. Brett screwed his eyes shut like a child afraid of the dark and the things that might be in it. His hands clenched into fists as he fought to hold his mental shields in place. Suddenly as that, the assault was over, and the pressure was gone. He opened his eyes and found Rose was looking at him curiously. Clearly, whatever he'd felt hadn't affected her. Before he could say anything, the door swung outwards into the corridor, and Brett and Rose had to retreat from it. The smell hit them first. It was a thick, rank, organic, but somehow dusty stench, full of age and decay and dead things. The kind of stench that had to build or accumulate over years, or maybe even centuries. There were noises, too. Brett could feel his heart hammering in his chest. Whatever was waiting in there, beyond the door, he just knew he didn't want to see it. He looked almost desperately at Rose. She had a disruptor in her hand, though Finn had forbidden her to take any weapons with her. Brett made himself breathe more slowly. The first step to composing himself. First rule of the con, never let the mark see how on edge you were. Never let them know how much making the deal mattered to you.
It seems we're expected. Let's go in and say hello.
Off to you.
Rose strode majestically forward into the gloom beyond the door, and Brett sauntered in after her. Inside, it was worse than he imagined. It was worse than he could have imagined. What little confidence he'd managed to wrap himself in was gone in a moment. The place could have been a chamber or a cavern carved out of the solid rock. It could have been some old storage room long abandoned. It could have been the antechamber to hell. There was no way of telling just how big the space was because it was entirely stuffed and choked with webbing. Thick gray and pink strands that stretched from wall to wall and from floor to ceiling, crossing and intertwining in delicate, intricate patterns, so labyrinthine and diverse that they hinted at infinity. Bodies, dead human bodies, hung suspended in the webbing here and there, low and high. Some were half consumed, with white shards of broken bone showing in the pale red meat. There were older, more mummified remains too, and the occasional clump of bare bones wrapped tightly together. In one corner, human skulls had been piled up, picked clean, and smeared with webbing, reaching almost to the concealed ceiling. The air was thick with death and decay, almost unbreathable. And everywhere, the pink and gray strands vibrated, gently, constantly, never entirely still. A narrow tunnel had been left open, a gap in the webbing, that led from the door to the center of the place, or chamber, or whatever the hell it might once have been, to where the only two living inhabitants sat side by side on old-fashioned chairs. Webbing crawled over and clung to them, too. It was immediately obvious that neither of the beings had moved from their chairs in a long, long time. Rose headed straight for them, plunging into the web tunnel, so of course Brett had to follow her in. Deep inside him, something was screaming. The tunnel through the webbing was only just wide enough for them both to walk down it side by side. Brett kept his arms pressed tightly to his sides, to be sure he wouldn't risk brushing up against the pink and gray strands. The two figures, sitting deathly still upon their ancient chairs, looked even more appalling the closer he got to them. They sat side by side, human in shape, but not in nature, their sunken faces lacking anything like human expression. The tops of their heads had been broken open long ago, or perhaps had burst open, and that was where all the webbing originated from. It grew up out of their heads, the pink and gray strands, extensions of their living brains. Consciousness spread across an entire room, endlessly generated, endlessly branching, all of it alive. Brett looked around him, shocked and sickened, as he realized he was walking through their shared mind. On the intertwining brain tissues, naked and slender and delicate, neurons sparked and flared like tiny fireworks. Rose and Brett finally came to a halt before the two seated figures. And for the first time, the indistinct figures moved slightly. Perhaps their eyes moved. Perhaps their slit mouths widened slightly in a smile. Perhaps they merely stirred in anticipation. One naked arm from each was reaching out across the gap between the chairs so that they could hold hands. They'd been holding hands for so long now that the flesh had grown together, fused into a single shape beyond hope of separation. Brett felt seriously sick. How long had these two been sitting here? Gray and pink matter sprouting from their exposed brains, feeding on whatever poor fools came to visit them.
We are the spider arms. We speak for the elves. Talk to us, little humans. Be bold and eloquent, and maybe afterwards we'll invite you to stay for dinner.
Brett would have turned and bolted right then, and to hell with Finn, if Rose hadn't been there with him. He knew she wouldn't run, and he couldn't leave her there in that awful place. So he made himself concentrate on the shrunken, shriveled pair before him, so he wouldn't have to look at the brain web or the half-devoured bodies hanging above and around him. Both the figures were so old, so wrinkled, so fallen in upon themselves, that it was impossible to even guess whether they were male or female. If they had ever worn clothes, they had long ago rotted and fallen away. And yet, though their faces were dead, their eyes were very much alive and aware. Brett immediately wished he hadn't made himself concentrate, as the smell hit him all over again.
Hello, I'm Brett Random, and this is Rose Constantine. We speak for Finn Durandal. Please don't kill us until you've heard us out. Fascinating place you have here. Love what you've done with it. How long have you been down here?
Long and long, little Random. Ever since the Mater Mundi made us, fashioning us from the humble clay of ordinary espers. It hurt us so much, so very much. But who were we to argue with the mother of all souls? She put us here, hidden behind the bedlam of so many alien minds, to think and calculate and solve problems for her. When problems grew too large for us, we grew larger to accommodate them. We were her brains, her creatures, made to serve her purposes. Of course, this was back in the days of the lion, in the grand old days of empire, when things were only just starting to go bad. But the Mater Mundi knew even then. She saw what was coming, so she made weapons, living weapons, infernal devices to be unleashed upon those who would oppose her. But something went wrong. The Mater Mundi never fully awakened until it was far too late. Now she is gone, but we remain. We serve the elves now, because our nature compels us to serve someone. And we have spent so very long waiting for revenge.
The lion? Lionstone's grandfather? Jesus, they've been down here for centuries, growing, spreading.
Why the corpses?
We cannot leave this place, and we're always hungry. Growth must be sustained. Tissues must be replenished. Don't shy away, little random. We are what we were made to be, by one far greater than any of us. We have worked wonders in our time. Our thoughts have traveled on paths unguessable to mere humans. The elves understand. We don't want to be found by the Oversoul. They would want to save us, make us sane again, separate us. We would rather die. We are great and marvelous, and we will not be denied our revenge, our long-delayed triumph.
Cool, this just gets better all the time. All right, why spider harps?
The two figures slowly raised their outer arms until their long bony fingers could reach the delicate strands fruiting from their opened heads. And then they plucked at the taut strands of the webbing. Fred slapped both his hands to his ears to keep the terrible music out, but the sound invaded his mind, harsh and strident and full of terrible significances. Fred dropped to his knees, his eyes squeezed tightly shut. He tried to shout something, but his voice wouldn't work. It was too small, too human, too sane. Rose moved in beside him, put a comforting hand on his shoulder, lifted her disruptor, and pointed it directly at the head of the figure on the left.
Stop that! Stop that right now!
The spider harps let their hands fall away from the neuron-studded strands. Brett slowly took his hands away from his ears. There were smears of blood on his palms. Rose hauled him to his feet again with one hand, while still keeping her disruptor carefully trained on her target.
You all right, Brett?
She didn't take her eyes off of her target.
I don't know. My head hurts. Makes a change. Didn't that music do anything to you?
I've never understood music.
Figures. Bless the Lord for his small mercies and pass the ammunition.
Brett glared at the spider harps.
I ought to let her shoot you.
You both have very interesting minds. You have strong shields, Brett Random, and we can't make sense of you at all, Rose Constantine. You're just too different. We had planned to possess you both, make you ours, take the Durandal's location from your minds, and then ride you back to him, and have you kill him, slowly, for our pleasure. But since that isn't possible, we will hear your proposal. What do you have to offer us?
Brett told them. There was a long pause, and then there was a new sound in the chamber. The spider harps were laughing.
We agree. Tell your master that the elves will work with the Durandal on this occasion to destroy the Paragons once and for all. You may leave now. But do come again. Your minds fascinate us. We can't wait to get our teeth into them.
Brett finally broke. He turned,
Mother,
and ran, plunging back through the tunnel in the webbing, past the great open door, and out into the corridor beyond. Rose backed slowly out, holding her disruptor on the spider harps all the way. But even after they'd both left that room, that chamber, that living hell, even after the door had slammed shut again, the laughter of the spider harps followed Brett and Rose all the way to the surface. Hellfire Club meetings always began with an orgy. Satisfy the body and its appetites to clear the mind. Indulge your every need and whim so that the mind is free to concentrate on other matters, so that the subtler joys of plotting and treason are not overshadowed by the more immediate pleasures of the flesh. The devils of the Hellfire Club made it a point of principle to deny themselves nothing. The huge hall's floor was covered from wall to wall with cushions and silks and all kinds of textures that might please. The air was thick with heady perfumes and generated pheromones. There was all kind of drink and every kind of drug, and everywhere, bodies moving together, clothed and unclothed as tastes and preferences decided, sinking themselves into each other and in the moment. Because that was what the Hellfire Club was all about. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And to hell with anyone who gets in the way. Afterwards, they all lay nakedly together, sitting or reclining as the sweat cooled and their breathing slowed, while the more subservient members moved among them with refreshing drinks and the more obscure and unpleasant forms of finger food, smiling happily as they were beaten and abused. The 100 or so members of the Hellfire Club who'd been able to make it to this meeting had gathered together to consider the troublesome matter of Finn Durendal. It promised to be a long meeting, but then they always were. Everyone was determined to be heard. Till Markham lay stretched out with his head cradled on an accommodating belly and looked thoughtfully about him. Till Markham belonged to many organizations, member of Parliament and the Shadow Court, supporter of pure humanity, rector of the official church, and long-standing devil in the Hellfire Club. He'd have joined the elves if they'd agreed to have him. Markham believed in obtaining every possible advantage, every possible form of support, on the unanswerable grounds that he never knew when he might need them. He belonged to so many secret and underground organizations that he'd almost lost count. His computers oversaw his extremely complicated diary and made sure he knew where he was supposed to be and why. Most of the organizations had no idea of his other connections. It was only polite. They also loved to believe that they were the only underground that mattered. Luckily, these days Markham was such an established member of Parliament that he only needed to make the occasional personal appearance for the most important of debates. The rest of the time, a low-level AI ran his holo for him and took notes for his staff to study later. They took care of the day-to-day business. That was what staff was for. Attending Hellfire Club meetings messed him about more than most, though, because the club's inner circle insisted on deciding a new location for every get-together, announced only hours in advance, thus protecting themselves from gatecrashers and infiltrators. Markham always made it to as many as he could. The club was currently occupying a deserted church in an area of the city marked for redevelopment. Is the church deconsecrated? Markham had asked on arriving. It soon will be, he'd been told, and Markham had forced a chuckle. The Hellfire Club consisted of circles within circles, from dilettantes and wannabes at the edges to the deadly philosophers at the very center. You could go in as deep as you wanted, or as deep as you could stand, but somehow there were always more circles inside those you'd thought were the innermost. This was partly to limit the number of people any member could betray if captured, but mostly because not everyone had the stomach for everything the Hellfire Club did, or planned to do. Markham was in pretty deep, and hoped to go even deeper, but though he was pretty sure he lacked anything even remotely like a conscience, there were still some things he wouldn't do. He was ambitious, not crazy. At the core, it was whispered, the founding members' extreme philosophy still survived. Complete anarchy for the Empire and humanity. A new empire, without conscience or mercy or restraint. Divine chaos, a time of awful pleasures and splendid suffering, where the lesser orders, those outside the club, would be slaves, objects, mere property, there to do all the necessary useful things, to be subject to their master's every whim, to live and die at their command, while the Hellfire Club made a glorious hell on earth for everyone. Markham didn't believe in any of that, not least because he didn't plan on sharing his power with anyone, but he had enough sense to keep his opinions on that matter to himself. To him, the Hellfire Club was just another useful tool, another means to get him what he wanted. He had a strong feeling a lot of members felt that way in private. Frankie started the discussion. She was a tall, almost unbearably voluptuous woman of a certain age, with sharp, vicious features and a great mane of pure white hair that reached all the way down her supple back to her waist. Markham loved to see her breathe, but had enough sense to keep out of her clutches. Unlike many of the Hellfire Club, she wasn't playing her role. She'd assassinated 27 people that Markham knew of. Two had been ex-lovers. Markham was pretty sure she was about as inner circle as you could get. Frankie was hardcore all the way.
So, what are we to do about the Durandal? Such a dear boy. We all know his plans, and he's come so far in such a short time. But I can't help feeling that he threatens to steal our thunder. The Hellfire Club are the official villains and demons of the Golden Age, by choice and popular acclaim. If anyone's going to bring the throne down, it should be us.
A pretty young thing of indeterminate gender voiced its opinion.
He means well, and I do so like to encourage new talent.
Kill him for his presumption! He should have come to us first. How dare he plan atrocities and not include us?
The man was so fat, Markham had to look away in disgust.
But don't you just love the idea of the greatest paragon of all time becoming the Empire's greatest villain? That a man who dedicated all his life to preserving the Empire and all it stood for should be the one to bring it all crashing down in ruins. Irony is so good for the soul. Let him have his fun. Let him do all the hard work gathering his followers and planning his plans. And when the throne is finally in danger, we will step out from the shadows and take it all over. Make the Durandal one of us, whether he likes it or not. That's the Hellfire Club way, after all.
Of course. Everyone can be seduced.
Frankie stretched her magnificent body with languorous ease.
You should know. Now, if you'll all excuse me, I'll leave you to sort out the details. I have another meeting to attend. The house will be in session soon, and my attendance is required.
Ah, yes. Have fun, my favorite member.
In his sumptuous office, surrounded by all the spoils of victory, Angelo Bellini, patriarch of the One True Church, was entertaining his second important visitor of the day. The previous patriarch's remains had been carefully scraped up and removed, and very thoroughly disposed of, and everything in the office was now back to normal. Though the extractor fans were still working overtime, Angelo stood up behind his impressive desk and nodded shortly to welcome the nearest thing the ecstatics had to a leader or spokesperson. The ecstatic was of average height and a little thinner than most, probably because he kept forgetting to eat. Living in a constant state of orgasm will do that to you. He wore a simple gray shift, smelled strongly, and seemed to drift as much as walk across the deep pile carpeting towards Angelo and his desk. Seen up close, the ecstatic wasn't very impressive. The constant, unwavering smile was definitely disturbing, though, and there was something about the eyes. Angelo waved to the chair on the other side of his desk. He was damned if he was going to shake hands. The ecstatic sank almost bonelessly into the hard-backed visitor's chair, while Angelo made himself extremely comfortable in his rather more luxurious seat of power.
Oh, call me Joy. It's a use name, of course. I don't have the patience for formal names anymore. And who I might have been in the past is of no interest to you or to me. It's good to be here. It's good to be anywhere. We met briefly at Douglas's coronation, you and I. Exchanged a few words. Or perhaps we didn't. It's so hard to be sure about things that don't really matter. I love chocolate.
Oh, well done. You were almost coherent there for a while, if not particularly valuable. Are you comfortable?
Oh, I'm always comfortable. Really, you have no idea.
Could you please stop smiling like that? It's not natural.
Not for you, perhaps. For me, the world is good. So large and wondrous and full of pleasure. Call me Joy. You called, and here I am. You've done a lot with this place. I don't like it. Someone died here recently.
Angelo looked sharply at the ecstatic. He'd never had much time for the extravagant claims made for the ecstatic supposed powers of insight. But that last remark, so casually made, was certainly unsettling. Angelo made himself relax. The ecstatic could say any damn thing he liked. It didn't matter.
The church's previous patriarch, the very venerable Roland Wentworth, has resigned. Reasons of ill health. He's gone, and he won't be coming back. I have, therefore, replaced him as patriarch. I lead the Church of Christ Transcendent, the glorious church militant, and there is no room in the new church for such as you, for such ostentatious self-indulgence. The new church is all about service and loyalty and rigid self-discipline. You do nothing to advance the cause. You are incapable of serving in the holy war to come, and your very nature brings the church into disrepute. You disgust me. I have, therefore, taken the decision to excommunicate all ecstatics and ban the surgeries that produce you. You will all be expelled, denied the comforts and protection of Mother Church. You don't fit in with our new image.
Angelo realized he was saying more than he'd meant to, more than he needed. But there was something about the calm, unwavering smile and gaze of the ecstatic before him that goaded him, made him try to find something that would crack that serene self-control. He wanted to hurt the ecstatic, frighten him, make him squeal and cry and beg for mercy. Not that it would make any difference, of course.
You don't want us around because you can't afford to tolerate the existence of any other power base in the church that might oppose your will. I knew this was coming. We all did. It's why I'm here.
You knew? How could you know? Who talked? None of my people would have talked.
No one had to tell us. You never understood who and what we are, Angelo Bellini. What we see and what we know. With our bodies freed from the demands of the now, our minds are freed to roam through past, present, and future. Our thoughts are unlocked, unshackled from the rigid restraints of rationality. I see through and beyond you, Angelo, as clearly as I see the functions of your desk. Behind you is the Durandal, and ahead of you is terror. We see so much, all of us. It's just that mostly we can't be bothered to tell anyone. There are light people who walk among you, unnoticed and unobserved, intent on their own unknown missions. There are angels in the skies and demons in the earth. We hear voices that aren't there and see things that may never happen. I have seen the future plummeting back into the past, and the dead rising to walk again. I see your aura, and it's really very ugly.
Shut up! Shut up, damn you!
All the hairs were standing up on Angelo's arms and on the back of his neck. He was sweating, and his hands were icy cold, as though someone had just walked over his grave. He was scared, horribly scared. And he didn't know why.
You're here because I ordered you here to listen to what I speak. You don't have to die. You could go back to the surgeons, go under the knife again. Let us put controls in your heads. Live on in service to the new church.
No, I don't think so. We won't go back to being human, to being only human. We'd rather die.
Die.
But even as his hand moved towards the control on his desk that would detonate the new transmutation bomb under the ecstatic chair, Joy leaned over suddenly, reached under his seat, ripped out the bomb, and held it up before him. He looked at it curiously for a moment, and then tossed it across the desk, aimed nicely to land right on the control that would activate it. Angelo erupted out of his chair to grab the bomb with both hands. He moved quickly away from the desk, put the bomb down on the floor very carefully, and then backed away from it, his mind full of the awful death of the previous patriarch. He spun around, suddenly sure Joy would be leaning over his desk with his hand poised over the activation pad, but there was no sign of the ecstatic anywhere. He'd left as silently as he'd come, while Angela was preoccupied.
How could he have known the bomb was under the chair? What else did he know? And who might it tell it to? And what one ecstatic knows.
Angelo leaned over his desk and hit the comm panel with unnecessary force.
Security! There's an ecstatic loose in the building! Kill it! Shoot it on sight! And when you're sure the unnatural thing is dead, bring the body here to my office so I can see it for myself.
Security sped through the cathedral at a run, driven on by Angelo's increasingly hysterical orders, but the ecstatic was nowhere to be found. No one saw him leave, and he didn't show up on any of the security monitors, which should have been impossible. So Angelo got on the comm again to some of his more fanatical Neumann supporters and personally gave the death order for all the ecstatics, in any city, on any world. Let them see what excommunication from the new church really meant. Let the law bleat what it liked. By the time they got their act together, it would be all over. And if any of his Neumann assassins should be caught, well, fanatics were always so eager to become martyrs for their cause. The ecstatics as a movement were finished. They were already as good as extinct. They were history. But somehow, that didn't comfort Angelo Bellini at all.
Ahead of you is terror.
Within the hour, the Parade of the Endless was swarming with Neumann fanatics, proud in their new church armor, hunting down ecstatics with gun and steel and missionary zeal, killing them openly in the streets. The peacekeepers mobilized in force to stop them, calling in reinforcements from all the surrounding cities, but still they were too widely spread and greatly outnumbered. Excommunicated, condemned, and damned by the church as heretics, the ecstatics were thrown out of their seminaries, retreats, and churches, and the doors slammed and locked behind them. No one in the church would hide or succor them. No one dared. The Neumann ran through city streets howling like wolves, blood dripping thickly from their blades. Most of the ecstatics were easy targets. They didn't run. They walked calmly through the streets, unwilling or unable to defend themselves. They smiled kindly on their murderers, making no attempt to escape, and they died easily, still smiling their disturbing smiles. The bodies piled up, and blood ran in the gutters of the perfect city. When individual peacekeepers got in the way, the Neumann cut them down too. The Paragon Emma Steele heard shooting and came swooping down on her gravity sled to see half a dozen Neumann assassins in church militant trappings pursuing a lone ecstatic down a main street. They were openly firing disruptors, but somehow their target was never where they aimed. He ran down the middle of the road, luckily free of traffic for the moment, while people lined both sides of the street and jeered and yelled crude insults at the running man. They scattered like sheep as Emma's sled came shrieking down at full speed, and she slammed it to an abrupt halt between the running Neumann and their prey. The six men stumbled to a halt as she jumped lithely down from her sled, her gun and sword already in her hands. They were fanatics, but they knew who she was. They looked at each other, and then at the ecstatic, standing quietly just beyond Emma's hovering sled, looking back at them, smiling. The Neumann looked at Emma Steele, slowly advancing on them, and anywhere else they would probably have done the sensible thing and turned and run. But their senses were maddened by the chase, blood from their previous kills still dripping from their weapons. And after all, there were six of them against just one Paragon. And they knew from the riot that sometimes Paragons die just as easily as anyone else. One man raised his energy gun. The force shield on Emma's arm intercepted the blast, and the energy beam ricocheted harmlessly away. Emma's sword was a blur as it cut through throated gut. She surged forward while her first two victims were still crumpling to the blood-spattered ground. And then she was in and among the other four before they knew what was happening. She killed them all in a matter of moments, and then looked unhurriedly about her. Six dead men lay in bloody heaps in the street, and she wasn't even breathing hard. The crowd lining both sides of the street were silent, their faces sullen, angry, cheated out of the death they wanted. One of them stepped forward, her face drawn in cold, ugly lines. She glared at Emma Steele.
How dare you interfere in God's work? He's an abomination! He has to die!
She looked around her, seeking support.
Kill the abomination! The Paragon can't stop us all!
I can stop you.
Emma pointed her disruptor at the woman's forehead.
And you'd be surprised how many people I can cut down if I get annoyed enough.
The crowd looked at the dead Neumann in the street and began to break up and drift away. They might believe in the principles of pure humanity, but they weren't ready to die for them. Not yet, anyway. The would-be rabble-rouser glared at Emma one last time, spat at the ecstatic, then turned and walked away. Emma kept her gun trained on the woman's back until she disappeared down a side street, and then she put the gun away and turned back to study the waiting ecstatic. He was standing right beside her, still smiling. Emma gave him her best glare.
What the hell was that all about?
I am Joy. You must protect me. It is necessary. I know things that matter. I see the Empire that's coming, born in blood and terror. I see legends walking and heroes gone bad. Your aura is really quite magnificent, you know. The Light People swarm around you like moths drawn to a blowtorch. The one you trust most will betray you. It's really very sad, but then most things are.
What are you talking about? Why were those Neumann creeps trying to kill you? The Khan channels are full of dead ecstatics all over the city. What is going on?
We are excommunicated. Our murder has become a blessed act. The angel says so. Mostly, we don't care. Life and death aren't nearly as different as most people think. However, I am different. You may have noticed. I know things. Secrets. Past, present, and future. I can't tell you what. Others might rip the knowledge from your mind.
All right. That last bit actually made some sense. You better come with me. I'll see you put in protective custody until we can sort this madness out.
Alas, no. There's nowhere you can put me that they couldn't find me. Neumann walk through walls and under doors now. Only one place in this world for such as me. You must take me there. Guard and protect me all the way. Take me to New Hope, Emma Steele, for all our souls' sake.
The Esper City? The heart and home of the Oversoul? What makes you think they'd put themselves on the line to protect you?
Because the Mind People still remember what it was like to be hunted.
Emma couldn't argue with that. She looked around her. She and the Ecstatic were the only people left on the deserted street, but any number of faces were watching from windows. Someone would have called the church by now. Which meant more Neumann assassins were undoubtedly already on the way. And if Joy really did know something that he wasn't supposed to know, something dangerous enough to threaten the new popularity of the church militant... Emma smiled unpleasantly.
All right, Joy, you've got yourself a ride. Get up on the sled behind me. But keep your hands to yourself, and if you get airsick, try and aim most of it over the side. And pray the Espers will be as welcoming as you think. No one gets into New Hope without permission.
My point, exactly.
Emma grinned despite herself, led him back to her hovering gravity sled, helped him on board, and took off, climbing for the clouds as fast as the engine could take her, to avoid providing a target for rooftop snipers. The sooner she got to New Hope, the better. She couldn't have felt more of a target if she'd had a bullseye painted on her back.